The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Okay, well, my iPhone says it's time to start, so I think we'll get started. Well, good morning. My name is Jim Nance. This is Teaching Reasoning Skills in Classical Classrooms. Let's open in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for the encouragement that we've received this morning from Dr. Grant and from others. Father, thank you for the opportunity to be here to encourage one another. Lord, I pray that you would encourage us this hour. Help us to teach in our classrooms and run our schools in a way that pleases you, in a way that serves the families that have put their children in our charge. Father, I pray that you would bless me as I speak. Give me words to say that would be encouraging and truthful and helpful to all who are here. Pray that you would bless my hearers as well. Father, help us all to serve you with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. In Jesus' name, amen. A lot of people have asked me, as a logic teacher and a writing of logic curriculum, how do we integrate logic into other courses? The answer is, learn logic. Any questions? It's my PowerPoint. I'm kidding. The stated purpose of the trivium is to teach students to think on their own. Dorothy Sayers said, "For the sole true end of education is simply this, to teach men how to learn for themselves, and whatever instruction fails to do this is effort spent in vain." Classical education does not only concentrate on teaching subjects, it also concentrates on teaching students how to think. And we believe that God has made the minds of children to develop in stages. The trivium seeks to consider the child's frame, to go with the grain by teaching students according to their strengths at those different stages. We call those stages Paul Parrott, Pert, and Poetic, corresponding roughly to upper elementary, junior high, and high school. They've also been compared fruitfully to input, processing, and output. You can tell I have a daughter who is in computer science. The Paul Parrott stage, in the Paul Parrott stage, the students want input. They like to collect things, not only stamps and rocks and animal figurines and communion cups, like my daughter. They also like to collect information. Dorothy Sayers says that their master faculties are observation and memory. They observe things in the world around them. They like to learn what those things are called. They like to know the names of things. What is that kind of airplane, Dad? It's an F-15, son. What is this kind of rock? Ask Mr. Struble. And they feel like that. They feel that they've learned something if they're able to identify things by name. They prefer learning by heart to learning by reasoning. Pert stage students at the junior high level, their master faculty is discursive reasoning. They want to process the input that they've been given. They like to take things apart, analyze it, see how it fits together. Young teenagers want everything to be proven. You watch a lightning storm outside your hotel window and you tell your son there was a lightning storm. You know the bolt of lightning is hotter than the surface of the sun? And he says, "Really? How do you know that, Dad?" You say, "Well, Wikipedia. I was interested. I wanted to know." You teach them that God brought about the crucifixion of Christ. that evil men are still responsible for what they did? And he'll say, how is that possible, Dad? You say that, you know, if you take 0.99999, if you go out forever, it exactly equals one and you can prove it. He says, oh, really? Well, prove it. Okay. Once they learn the tools of analysis and proof, their trained intelligences move into the poetic stage. They begin to desire to synthesize their learning and express the synthesis. They start to see the connections between various subjects, and if taught well, they start to break down the walls between classes. They become more expressive and creative. In classical Christian schools, we seek to teach our high school students not primarily to express themselves. Why would we want to do that? But to express the truth, to express it effectively with eloquence and persuasion. Well, I want to concentrate this hour on the second of those three stages. The PERT stage, the logic stage, if we can call it that. If PERT stage students want everything that they are learning to be analyzed and proven, then we should teach them to go. We should go with the grain and teach them proper methods of analysis and proof with the core truths that are presented in every subject. So let me define my key terms: core truth, analysis, and proof. The core truths are those truths which, according to the teacher, embody the essential lessons in every subject. And I say according to the teacher because a large part of what our students learn is us. Students go to class and learn Jim Nance, learn Scott Mahurin, learn, you know, all of your names. Sorry? Phil Arendt. And others out there. But there are truths that we want to teach our students, truths that we want them to know, truths that we believe to be essential, truths that if we don't teach these truths, we really haven't taught our class as fully as we should. So those of you who are secondary teachers, let's do a little experiment here. I want you to think of your favorite class that you teach. If you're a teacher, your favorite class you teach. And on the count of three, tell me what that class is. One, two, three. Excellent. Okay, me too. It's my favorite class. You all said logic. So ask yourself, in that subject, what are the most important truths that I want to get across to my students? Which truths cannot be left out without significant loss to the student's understanding of the subject? I'm calling those the core truths. Now, by analysis, I mean the analysis of a logical argument, taking an argument apart to see if the conclusion really does follow from the premises. In our case, verifying that the core truth really is logically supported by the other information. We analyze the arguments of others when we consider whether or not they have reached a proper conclusion. We were looking to see, is their reasoning valid reasoning? Proof means the construction of an argument, putting an argument together, showing not only that the conclusion follows from the premise or the premises, but why it follows, how it follows. Starting with a given body of information, reaching intermediate conclusions step by step from that information, justifying each step, explaining how it follows from the previous steps, and finally reaching that final conclusion, that core truth. And I'm going to show you some examples here in a minute. Well, my main point here, to give away my thesis at the beginning, my main point is that each class must analyze or prove the core truths of its particular subject. You should be leading your students through an analysis or proof of all the core truths of your particular subject. Okay, well, let me give you some examples of possible core truths for different subjects. American history. The colonies were justified in declaring their independence from the King of England. This comes out right out of our curriculum guide. I don't teach American history. But I would argue that if this truth is not taught in American history, then American history is not being fully or properly taught. Our students should be able to prove this. If we're going to claim this, our students shouldn't just believe it. If it's true, they should be able to prove that it's true. New Testament. Jesus Christ fulfilled the messianic prophecies of the Old Testament. No student should be able to pass a New Testament class without being able to prove this. Latin. Proper translation is more than just a word-for-word substitution. Now, some students may start a Latin class thinking that they can just substitute word-for-word, but no student should be able to finish a Latin class and still think that. Language doesn't work that way, and they need to learn that. In English, all stories have setting, characters, and a plot. Again, this is straight out of our curriculum guide. Earth science. The Earth and other planets revolve around the sun. If you were here in my talk yesterday and on mathematics, you see why I think this is a core truth and one that students ought to be able to prove. The proof of this is very difficult. It's something that most of us just take for granted. It's a fascinating story behind it all. Advanced algebra. If ax squared plus bx plus c equals 0, then x equals negative b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac divided by 2a. I promised people I wouldn't spend too much time on math. But your students ought to be able to prove this from advanced algebra. They ought to know how to complete the square and go from there to there. If they can't do that, there's a core truth that they can't prove. And that, you know, if anything, that's a core truth from advanced algebra. Right? So when such claims are made, PERT stage students will want them to be proven, since they want everything to be proven. So we should teach our students how to prove these truths so that they not only learn the material, they learn how to learn the material. That's what we're about as classical educators. Not just to teach the concepts, not just to teach our classroom content, but to teach our students how to reason through our classroom content. Now, truths which are not necessarily core truths, which I call secondary truths, should also be analyzed or proven. Whenever a claim is made in a class, which would cause the students to ask, how do we know this is true? Now, don't put them at the same level as my core truths, but we teach a lot of truths that are not necessarily what I would call core truths. American history. The Battle of D-Day was the turning point of World War II. Well, you might claim that in class, and then the students will say, well, how do you know? Why do you think that? Now, but I wouldn't call it a core truth. I think someone could pass an American history class and think that the Battle of Britain was the turning point of World War II or something like that. Old Testament Bible. The Exodus from Egypt occurred around 1440 BC. Well, there's dispute about this. Some people would argue for more like a 1290 BC Exodus. Geometry. The surface area of a sphere is exactly four times the area of a circle of the same radius. I think that's really fascinating. Maybe that tells you more about me than it tells you about geometry. But I think a student could graduate from or pass a geometry class and not remember that particular truth. American literature. Anne Bradstreet was the first significant American poet. Came out of our curriculum guide. But I wouldn't call it a core truth. It's important. Earth science. The gas giant planets all have rings. Well, students might forget that Jupiter and the other gas giants have rings. If they forget that Saturn has rings, you're missing something. These claims are not at the same level as the core truths. They're either not as essential to their subjects or they're debatable, but they are claims which the teacher should be able to prove or lead his students through a proof of if he mentions them in class as true. Now, let me give one note. As we develop our core truths, we need to distinguish core truths that are proven from core truths that are foundational assumptions, which are not proven. For example, in my doctrine class, our first statement of faith is, we believe the Bible alone to be the Word of God, the ultimate and infallible authority for faith and practice. I don't try to prove this. I assume this in order to prove everything else. And a lot of our core truths are at that level. Okay, certainly a core truth, but not one that I start by trying to prove. Logic starts by assuming that a statement is either true or false. This is one of my core truths, certainly, but it's not one that I try to prove. It's something that I assert. If I defend it at all, I'd talk about the Christian worldview aspect of logic and how this comes from the nature and character of God. In science assumes that we're able to perceive reality through our senses. It's something science starts with, But it's certainly something that I would argue is a core truth in science. My point here is that all proof has to start somewhere, and sometimes our foundational assumptions are themselves core truths. So how do we go about analyzing and proving the truths that we teach? Well, we learn how to do this sort of thing by learning logic. There are two main types of argument which require different approaches, deductive reasoning and inductive reasoning. I want to run through this quickly. Deductive arguments are based on axioms, statements that are assumed to be true. Our foundational assumptions are axioms. These are how we start arguments, like all men are created equal. When I say start arguments, I don't mean start fights. I mean how we begin a logical argument. Okay, although this one certainly started an argument. In the second way, all men are created equal. Now, deduction draws conclusions from these statements, conclusions that are either valid or invalid. So all men are created equal with equal rights. Americans are men just like Englishmen. Therefore, deductively, Americans have the same rights as Englishmen. This is a valid deductive argument. If the argument is valid and the premises are true, then the argument is sound. The argument is unsound either if the conclusion doesn't follow from the premises, if the argument's not a valid one, or if the conclusion would follow from the premises, but the premises themselves are not true. So if you have a false argument, even if it's valid, it's still unsound. So let me give you an example of an unsound deductive argument. If God existed, there would be no evil in the world. But there is evil. Therefore, God does not exist. This is a valid argument. The conclusion follows from the premises. But this is an unsound argument. The conclusion is false because one of the premises are false. And your students should be able to figure out which of the premises are false. So we can have a valid argument that's not true. If all American presidents are women, and if all women have 3 feet, then all American presidents have 3 feet. The conclusion follows from the premise, even though every statement was false there. Okay, that was weird. Sorry. Inductive arguments. Inductive arguments are based not upon accepted truths, not upon axioms, but on experience. So things like the speed of sound in air is 331 meters per second. We learn that by experience. No large democracy is an effective form of government. If you wanted to prove this, you would prove it by experience. You'd look at the examples of past large democracies and how they were ineffective and why. The conclusions of inductive arguments are not sound or unsound, not valid or invalid, but they're strong or weak, depending on how well the experience supports the conclusion. The more the experience or experiments or examples support the conclusion, the stronger the conclusion. If you only did one experiment to find the speed of sound, the conclusion would be a weak one. You need to do it more than once. You need to do it in different situations, in different temperatures, different locations, things that might change things. If you only considered America to show that no large democracy is an effective form of government, that would also be weak. You need to consider many examples of past democracies from different times and places in order to strengthen arguments. Now, for some claims, both methods can be used. Let me give some examples. We all learned that in the absence of air effects, objects of different masses dropped from equal heights will land at the same time. Now, if you actually read Galileo on this, you see that he proves this both ways. He proves it inductively by actually doing the experiment. He says, I, who have made the test, can assure you that a cannonball weighing 100 or 200 pounds will not reach the ground by as much as a span ahead of a musket ball weighing only 0.5 pound, provided both are dropped from a height of 200 cubits. Now that sounds to me like someone who actually did it. Don't know where he did it from, because the Leaning Tower of Pisa is only 195 feet tall. But it still sounds to me like someone who did it. He also proves it deductively by considering what would happen if two bodies of different masses were connected. So he says, assume different bodies fall at different speeds. If we take two bodies whose natural speeds are different, it is clear that on uniting the two, the more rapid one will be partly retarded by the slower, and the slower would be somewhat hastened by the swifter. But if this is true, and if a large stone moves with a speed, say, of 8, while a small stone moves with a speed of 4, then when they are united, the system will move with a speed less than 8. But the two stones tied together make a stone larger than that which moved at the speed of 8. Hence, the heavier body moves with a speed less than the lighter, an effect which is contrary to the assumption. Therefore, two bodies of different masses will fall at the same speed. It's a brilliant bit of deductive reasoning on Galileo's part. Now, in our science classes, we use both approaches occasionally. One example of that is proving Kepler's third law of planetary motion, that the square of a planet's period is proportional to the cube of its mean distance from the sun. So the time it takes the planet to go around the sun is the period. Square that number, and that's going to be directly proportional to the cube of the distance, the radius, if you will, if it's a circle, of the planet from the sun. Now, in Earth science, we do what Johannes Kepler did. We find this inductively. We look at the time and distance data. You know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, he didn't look at some of those later planets. But you look at their orbital period, or orbital radius, especially if you put it in astronomical units like I have here, so the Earth is 1. And the orbital period, if you look at it in years, and here again, that in that case, the Earth would have the number 1. Then, of course, for the Earth, the square of the radius is proportional to the cube, or I'm sorry, the square of the period proportional to the cube of the radius, and the constant of proportionality is 1. Well, looking at it that way, this is what we show our students, and then we ask them, try to figure out some sort of relationship to, make the values on the right equal the values on the left. Try plugging them into different equations. And eventually, some smart kid comes up with, if you square those and you cube those, you get the same value. Okay, and that's an inductive approach. You just try different things. But our physics students, following Isaac Newton, find this law deductively, using his laws of gravity and centripetal force. Okay? So they take, I teach them that in my physics class that in regarding planetary motion, gravity is the centripetal force. Gravity is the force that keeps them moving in an orbit. And so we can set those two forces equal to each other, and then cancel the mass of the planet and put 2 pi over the period in for omega there and simplify things a little bit. And you keep going and you find out, sure enough, this square of the period is proportional to the cube of the radius. But you find out something more deductively. You find out what that constant of proportionality is, that it depends on pi, of all things, and upon the universal gravitational constant and the mass of the sun. You get more from it deductively than you got inductively. And you can also solve it in a matter of a couple minutes if you know what you're doing. It's a big if there. Well, formal logic, the PERT stage key exercise, teaches the methods of analysis and proof. Logic teaches, for example, the method of proof by reductio ad absurdum, which was the argument type that Galileo used to prove that two masses fall at the same speed. This means that when your students learn logic, that they'll be more adept at following the analysis of the argument of core truths. It also means that teachers at the PERT stage should have a working knowledge of the techniques of logic, especially those techniques that will be presented here, which means reading books and working through them. Not necessarily my books, although those are my books down there. And we should recognize that different subjects will analyze their core truths in different ways. We prove things differently in Bible than we prove them in physics. So let's start with a familiar case, geometry. Geometry provides us with a good model of how to go about examining our core truths. Euclidean geometry starts with an established set of assumptions, undefined terms, the point, line, and plane, and so on, defined terms. Collinear means lying on the same line. Postulates, which are statements that are assumed to be true, like 2 points determine a line and things like that. So now, these starting points are then expanded using the rules of strict deductive logic. Theorems are proved, which are then used as premises for further theorems. The theorems of geometry are shown to be valid deductions from the premises. So to demonstrate, let's run through the proof. The sum of the interior angles of a triangle equal 180 degrees. Remember this from your geometry class. Anybody, how many of you remember how to prove this? How many of you could prove it right now? Okay, so 2 or 3 hands. Good. Maybe 4. Good job. Okay, well, let's run through the proof. So we assume a triangle with interior angles A, B, and C. That's our given. That's what we start with. And then Euclid's fifth postulate says it's possible to draw a line parallel to another line through a point not on the line. And that's what we do. We draw a line L parallel to line AC through the base of the triangle. That's Euclid's fifth postulate. Well, we know that A prime plus B plus C prime equals 180 degrees because the linear measure equals 180 degrees. And then we know that A equals A prime because those are alternate interior angles, and we had proven that sometime earlier in our geometry class. And C equals C prime. And then by the substitution axiom of Euclid, therefore, we substitute A for A prime and C for C prime, and we get, sure enough, that A plus B plus C is 180 degrees. Which is really kind of fun. I think it's kind of fun. Okay. That we can prove things like that. And something that when you first look at it, you might go, I have no idea how I'd go about proving that. And then you see it and you go, oh, yeah, of course. It just, there's something surprising about the obvious nature of it. Well, different subjects will follow a similar, and that's a key word there, similar procedure to prove their core truths. Bible. In Bible, one core truth mentioned earlier is the doctrine of the Trinity, that one God exists eternally in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The argument might run like this. Well, the Bible is infallible. It's true in all that it teaches. Now, this is one of our assumptions. This is the core truth we start with. And the Bible teaches that there is one God who exists eternally in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Therefore, there exists one God who eternally in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That's a pretty boring argument. Now, any purge stage student would look at that and say, okay, that's not enough. Prove it. You know? Where does the Bible teach that there's one God who exists eternally in three persons? Anybody know who that girl is? Okay, I thought there would be someone in the audience who would. Pulled her off of a website from the school, local school. Yeah. I was hoping I didn't get in trouble. So you'd say, well, the Bible teaches that there's one God. Deuteronomy 6:4, Isaiah 45:5. The Bible teaches that the Father is eternally God, John 3:16. The Son's eternally God, John 1:1 and 14. The Spirit's eternally God, Acts 5:3 and 4, and so on. Until the reasonable student is satisfied. Notice that key word. Okay. So that's how we can prove things in Bible. In science, in the experimental sciences, many of the core truths are proven using the scientific method. We have observations that lead to a hypothesis. The hypothesis is tested by controlled experiments. From these experiments, we make inductive conclusions. And then we reach our core truth. Now, often, the science students do experiments to verify something that they've been told is true. You're told, probably, first of all, that the speed of sound is 331 meters per second in air at standard temperature and pressure. So then we go and try to prove that. We prove it inductively. We go do an experiment. Much of my physics class is occupied with proving things deductively using math, and then verifying it inductively. So, for example, we prove deductively Archimedes' principle of buoyancy, that an object submerged in fluid is buoyed up by the weight of the fluid displaced. Prove that deductively. It's a fun, pretty simple deductive proof. And then we verify it inductively. I bring in this huge tank that we have that's made of glass, fill it with water, and I get a can of... I used to do this. Oh, this is embarrassing. I get a can of Pepsi and a can of Diet Pepsi. The can of Pepsi used to sink and the can of Diet Pepsi used to float. They both float now. I don't know what happened. What they do to the sugar? Something changed. It's embarrassing. Didn't work this year. I said, hey, wait a second. One of these is supposed to float and one of these is supposed to sink. The Pepsi is supposed to sink and the Diet Pepsi is supposed to float. So I got to come up with some other way of doing that experiment. Okay. Some of the core truths are beyond our time or resource to prove. Kepler's first law of planetary motion, the planets orbit the sun in elliptical orbits, our students have the ability to prove this. If you ran them through the proof, it would take a while, but they have the ability to prove it. But it's a long, arduous, difficult mathematical proof. A lot of plotting points and things like that. So this is perhaps beyond our time to prove. The speed of light is about 300,000 kilometers per second. I proved this in college. I remember doing the experiment at the university. But it's probably beyond our budget to do it in high school. The center of the Earth is a core of heavy metal is beyond our ability to prove this. So we can't prove these experimentally, but we should be able to lead our students through the analysis of arguments of other people that have proven these things. Our students should know how these things are proven. And for a lot of them, they should actually read the arguments, read the defense of these kind of secondary truths, or truths that are beyond our ability or time or money to prove. Okay, literature may prove many of its core truths by definition, by example. For example, consider the core truth that all narrative stories have a setting, character, and a plot. So I saw this from our curriculum guide, so I said, I wonder how we go about proving this. And so I pulled the Warner's English grammar book from our English teacher's shelf, and I opened it up and looked, where do they prove this? And it said, setting. They say every story happens somewhere at some time. And so they seem to establish this by definition. And then they do give one example. They say that O. Henry set many of his stories in New York in the early 1900s. Say, okay, bad induction. Only one example, but it's a good start. You know, really, you know, if you're going to define something by definition and you give one example, a good perch stage student would be satisfied with that. Characters. Every story has at least one leading character. They seem to leave this one assumed. They say the story has to be about someone doing something, but they don't argue much more beyond that. Plot. A writer can set a group of characters somewhere at some time and still not have a story. Something has to happen. And then they prove this one by example. They give a story about a girl who drops out of school, wanders around the city, gets lost, gets found, returned home to finish school. Okay. Yay. Okay. So setting characters in a plot. Now, such a proof may or may not satisfy the perch stage student. So if I was teaching English and reading through these pages, and I had a student say, yeah, how do we know that every story has to have at least one leading character? I would probably give them this assignment. Write a story without a character. See if you can do it. If they can, then I would change my definition. If they can't, I would say, okay, you know, well, that's pretty good evidence that you need characters in a story. History may prove many of its core truths by historical induction, considering cause and effect, perhaps by definition in a lot of cases. I mentioned that the Battle of D-Day was the turning point of World War II. How would we go about proving that? Well, the truth of this claim turns upon the definition of turning point. A turning point occurs when you're going one direction, and then at some time you start going in a different direction, just by definition. Well, what was the situation before and after the Battle of D-Day? D-Day was the turning point because the sides of offensive and defensive switched at that time. The Allies were now on the offensive, taking back land. Germany was forced out of land that they once had control of, and so on, improving each point as necessary. And that's how you go about proving things in history. Language may prove many of its core truths by example, or perhaps by analogy. Just a few examples would be needed to prove that a good translation from the Latin is more than just a word-for-word substitution. So, proof by example. Here's our school motto, Non nobis domine, sed nomine tuo da gloriam. Now, you do a word-for-word substitution, and it's pretty awkward. Not us, Lord, but name yours, give glory. Okay, but we would translate it, not to us, Lord, but to your name, give glory. And the student sees by example that a word-for-word substitution, even when you are careful to translate each word accurately, isn't sufficient to translate a sentence. Now, the logic for different subjects will probably not be as strict as the logic of geometry or formal logic. Some things will be left assumed. Some trivial steps will perhaps be skipped. It would be awkward and unnecessary for every class to follow the strict deductive sort of reasoning that we follow in a geometry class. But whatever the method, all PERT stage students should have practice analyzing the reasoning supporting the foundational truths of whatever subject they're studying. These truths should be proven to the extent that the reasonable student is satisfied. Classes should also examine the popular errors common to their particular subject. The teaching of most subjects includes the teaching of errors which people have made in the past. And we learn how to do this from logic also. Sayer says, indeed, the practical utility of formal logic lies not so much in the establishment of positive conclusions as in the prompt detection and exposure of invalid inference. Now, as I mentioned earlier, an argument can go wrong in two main ways. the premises can be false, or the reasoning can be inductively weak or deductively invalid. If the premise or the starting assumptions are false, it doesn't matter if the argument is valid or not. We can't trust the conclusion. So let's look at some false premises that have been made in different subjects in the past. In the Bible, it was once assumed early in the Christian era that Jesus cannot be fully God and fully man. Now, that false assumption led to several theological heresies. A good doctrine class would teach those different errors that came from this false assumption and teach who promulgated these errors. How are these errors corrected? In math, it was once believed that the square roots of negative numbers are meaningless. Of course, it's ridiculous. It's imaginary. And this prevented the analysis of many fascinating problems in engineering, in electronics. You need imaginary numbers. You need complex numbers for electronics. Similarly, if we were to deny that infinity was a meaningful concept, as the Greeks did, we could have a consistent mathematical system, but we couldn't have calculus. This is an assumption that was made that kept the Greeks from discovering things that they should have otherwise found. In science, the classic example of a false assumption was geocentrism, that the planets and the sun orbit around the Earth. Okay? This led to many false ideas about our solar system that we now recognize as errors. Now, the reason we recognize them as errors is a fascinating story. It's the proof that the Earth is a planet that goes around the sun is primarily an aesthetic proof. It's a different kind of a proof. If you want to read about it in a well-written book, read The Copernican Revolution by Thomas Kuhn. It's a great book. He shows how to run through that sort of argument. In whatever subject you teach, you should examine the errors that have been made in that subject. It was once taught that X, but we now believe Y. And we should be able to show that X was wrong. So, false premises is one problem. Invalid inference is another problem. Formal fallacies and informal fallacies are the two main ways that things go wrong deductively. Formal fallacies are, honestly, pretty rare in teaching, though they sometimes still occur. Let me give you one example. One example from science is affirming the consequent. If P, then Q. Q, therefore P. If mammals evolved from a common ancestor, then they would have common characteristics. Mammals do have common characteristics. Therefore, mammals all evolved from a common ancestor. Well, that's like arguing if you were a gorilla, you would have two legs. You do have two legs. Therefore, you are a gorilla. Yeah, it's a fallacy. Informal fallacies are more common. Science can fall into numerous informal fallacies. Ipsy Dixit's a popular one, an illegitimate appeal to authority. Aristotle was a genius. I like Aristotle. But objects don't fall at speeds proportional to their weights just because he said they did. Carl Sagan was a brilliant scientist. But there's not necessarily life on other planets just because he believed there was. We are not facing imminent disaster due to global warming, despite what Al Gore says. Historians have sometimes fallen into the fallacy of a post hoc ergo propter hoc, assigning a false cause due to chronology. Just because one event follows another in time doesn't mean the first event caused the second one. The Industrial Revolution of the 19th century was not necessarily caused by the Enlightenment of the 18th century just because it followed it in time. In Latin, chronological snobbery is a prevalent informal fallacy. Oh, Latin is a dead language of an ancient culture, so why do we bother teaching it? It's chronological snobbery. Just because it's old doesn't mean it's bad, doesn't mean it's useless. Latin did die. It's been resurrected. They should learn it. The Bible class should consider fallacies in biblical interpretation. A couple of good books here. Exegetical Fallacies by D.A. Carson. It's a good book for pointing out some fallacies in biblical interpretation. D.A. Carson's not afraid to offend you. also, The Doctrine of the Knowledge of God, a much thicker book. by John Frame has a great chapter on logic in our study of theology. He discusses fallacies made in biblical interpretation, the doctrine of the knowledge of God by John Frame. So as we teach about the errors that have been made in our subjects, we should use this opportunity to teach students the difference between the false premise, invalid inference, strong, weak, inductive reasoning, the difference between formal and informal fallacies. This is a good teaching opportunity. Now, we follow this dialectic tool of teaching, and when we do so, we are using subjects properly. The students are learning the most important material. They are learning their core truths. In our teaching, if we concentrate on proving the core truths of our particular subject, it will help our teachers and our students from being sidetracked into peripherals. Instead, you'll be teaching what you promised the parents that you would teach. But at the same time, the students are also learning how to think through a subject. They're not merely being given facts. Instead, they are learning how to reason. They are exercising their minds. You don't get in good shape just by having a set of weights in your house. You need to use them. Students learn to reason not by watching the teacher reasoning, but by reasoning. We need to use them. They need to use their brains. So that way, students are not only learning their subject, they're learning how to learn. It's very easy for us as teachers to let ourselves be content-driven. Good teachers are learners. We're all learning new content all the time. We're excited about the content that we're learning. We want to share it with our students. We're tempted to fill up our teaching time with the mere presentation of content. Oh, I discovered this new thing. This was really cool. But the teaching of content is not the whole of classical education. It's important, but it's not the whole. Mortimer Adler wrote, "Although the great books introduce every subject matter into this scheme of education, its aim is not the mastery of subject matter, but the acquisition of discipline." In a similar vein, Dorothy Sayers wrote, "To learn six subjects without remembering how they were learnt does nothing to ease the approach to a seventh. To have learned and remembered the art of learning makes the approach to every subject an open door." So, teach subjects. Teach content. There's truths out there that our students need to learn and need to know. But teach them how we know those truths. Action items. What do you need to do? Okay, here we go. If you're a teacher of students in the dialectic stage, you should, before school starts, prepare to prove the core truths of your subject. You should identify what you believe to be the core truths of your subject. Perhaps 10 to 20 different truths that you think are essential in the subject. If I leave this out, then I'm not teaching my subject fully. Those are the truths that you should be looking for. Before the school year starts, you should identify what those truths are. Take an hour, maybe less. You should clearly have in mind the worldview assumptions behind those truths. Some of these will be premises for arguments that are going to prove core truths. Others are foundational assumptions that you don't need to prove. You just tell your students, we're starting at this point. You have to start somewhere, and this is where we're starting, and that's fine. So identify those core truths. Write out in summary form the proof of the core truths, those that you are able to prove, to be prepared to show how the premises lead to the conclusions. For those core truths that you're unable to prove due to time or resource constraints, consider how you would lead the students through an analysis of the argument supporting those core truths that you're not able to prove. Also, be prepared to prove the secondary truths. Here, I would say, sometime before you teach the lesson. I could go into a school year not really knowing necessarily how to prove the secondary truth. But before I say in class, this is true, I should be prepared to either prove it myself or look at someone else's argument in support of it and analyze it to see if their reasoning is good. Similarly, be ready to explain the errors within your area of expertise which have been made in the past. Identify those major errors, and every subject has them. We've all made mistakes in the past. Our fathers made mistakes in the past. Find those errors and identify them. Determine what kind of errors they were. Were they false assumptions? Were they just starting at the wrong place? Thinking that something was true when it actually wasn't? Was it weak induction? Did they have too few examples? Did they take an example and think, this proves it, when in fact they weren't considering the fact that if you go to the top of a mountain, water doesn't boil at 100 degrees centigrade? And think, maybe there's something a little bit more general here. Or if you go on a warmer day and you find out that the speed of sound is 340 meters per second, you think, okay. And maybe our conclusion was a bit hasty. Okay. Was there weak induction there? Is there some formal fallacy being made? You need to learn the formal fallacies. This takes learning logic. There's not too many of them, and they're important to know. If we are classical educators, we need to be classically educated. Yeah. And that takes work on our part. I am a public school graduate from a large public school in Seattle. Okay. I had to learn a lot of this, almost all of this, on my own. Informal fallacies. You need to learn the names of those informal fallacies. That's going to happen a whole lot more often. And then be prepared to explain how the error was or can be corrected. Okay, how much time do I have? Going to 10:50, what time is it? Okay, here we go. Good. Time to practice. You all have pencil and paper. Think of that one class you teach, your favorite class. Do this for me right now. Write out one core truth that you want to teach your students or that you have taught your students in the past. Just give me one core truth. I'll give you a minute. Can't learn how to think by watching Mr. Nance think. You got to think on your own. I love doing that to my students, too. Sorry. Okay, that was fun. I know, I always wanted to get that on video. Sorry. Okay, now, so you got your core truth written. Now, figure out one secondary truth, one truth that isn't necessarily a core truth, something that is either debatable or something that that if you didn't teach it, it'd be okay. You could still say that the student understands the material. Figure out one core truth of your subject. I promise not to screen this time. And write it down. And when you're done with that, write out one error, one mistake that's been made in your subject in the past, something that was taught in the past as a truth that you believe to be in error. See if you can think of one of those as well. Okay, any English teachers out there? Okay, what core truth did you come up with? All essays have a thesis. All essays have a thesis. Excellent. How would you go about proving, anybody, that all essays have a thesis? How would you prove that core truth? Any ideas? Yes?
Definition: essay is written.
Okay, good. Okay, yeah, good. An essay is a written communication to prove an idea. An idea is a thesis, therefore all essays prove a thesis. Yeah, that's a good, strict deductive argument. Excellent. Okay, Any science teachers out there? Okay. What's one of your core truths, sir?
Heat is a form of energy.
Good. How would you go about proving that? That's a great one. How'd you go about proving that heat is a form of energy? You'd have to start by definition, right? Energy. Phil, what's the definition of energy? Energy is the ability to do work. How would you prove that heat allows us to do work? Work is force through a distance. How would you prove that? Good. So yeah, you could prove it in class by, you know, you could get a little boilerplate on wheels and bubble, you know, boil some water and get that steam moving through, you know, through a thin hole and making it spin something that made that little cart move. You know, that'd be proving it in sort of an inductive way. Or, you know, looking at Joule's experiment and running through how someone else proved that heat is a form of energy. That's a great example. History. Any history teachers out there? Oh, it's scaring you. Is there no history teachers here? Really? Oh, well, back in the back there. Okay, give me a core truth in history.
Civics history. So human law is just when it conforms to the law of God.
Human law is just when it conforms to the law of God. And Melissa, how would you go about proving that?
Well, define just.
Okay. Good. So start with the definition. A lot of arguments are going to do that, starting with definition. Okay. And then what would you do?
And then you would compare, well, then you would appeal to the Bible, and you would say that the Bible is the standard of what is just, then any basis for deduction from the definition. So human law would be unjust if it does not conform to the law of God, because the law of God is the standard of what is just.
Excellent. Good. Okay. Okay, we'll slide right past that. Any math teachers out there? Math? I didn't do math already, did I? Okay, so give me a core truth in mathematics.
When solving problems,
you have to follow an order of operations. Do what's in parentheses, multiply before adding, that sort of thing. Okay, and how would you go about proving that, or would you? Ah, excellent. Okay, so show that they don't get the same answer. Good. Okay, how about a secondary truth? Give me some examples of secondary truths. People who haven't spoken yet, just raise your hand. I'm not going to ask you to prove them, but I just want to hear some examples of secondary truths. Okay, secondary truths. Sir?
Any cross-section of a sphere is a circle.
Excellent. Chris? Okay, so the universe is, you said 6,000 years old? Okay.
Beowulf was written by a Christian.
Okay, great one. I love Beowulf. Hwatwegar denin yar dagum theud kuniga. Frim yafrunan hutha adalingus elden framadon. It's a great story. Read Beowulf in the original. Yes?
Without the Enlightenment, there would be no Holocaust.
Fascinating thesis. Okay. Good. Okay, and something that if you're going to make a claim like that in class, you would definitely want to be able to prove it to your students or have them argue it and prove it as well. Okay, how about an error that's been made in your subject in the past? Anybody? Any error that's been made in the past in their subject? Sir?
Pi equals 22 sevenths.
Okay, classic error in mathematics. Pretty close. If we call that an error, then any number we get for pi is an error in one sense or another, because we can never get it exactly. Okay? Others? Other errors that have been made? Okay, Chris? Okay, you can add a biblical genealogies and determine the age of the universe. We got to talk about this. Why is that an error? Okay, we'll talk about it. Okay? Man back there?
Hmm.
Okay. Okay. Problems with carbon dating. Good. Any others? One more. Non-math science. Ma'am? Stories must be told in chronological order. Okay. Yeah. Great example of an error that's been made in the past. Ah, excellent. Okay. And that's what I have for you. Thank you.